Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we're going through a lot these days with the pandemic, processing the deaths of loved ones, trying to make ends meet because our finances took a turn, or dealing with being cooped up too long. And the last thing on our lists, at least for some, is to be vulnerable and wade into open, honest conversations with others about what we're going through. But Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, says that's exactly when we need to. We'll learn more when she joins us after this news. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When Anna Sale's first marriage was unraveling, what ultimately helped her find a sense of clarity was talking to other people about the choices they'd made when they felt lost. This planted the seeds for what would later become Sale's popular podcast, Death, Sex, and Money, known for having honest conversations about taboo topics. But having those difficult conversations in real life can be a lot trickier than between two strangers on a podcast, says Sale in her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. But she says that should not stop us from trying. Anna Sale, welcome back to Forum.
Thanks, Mina. I'm so glad to be here.
And congratulations on your first book, which goes
Thank
on sale
you.
Today. That's very
today.
Exciting.
Thank
Yay.
You.
Well, first, I don't think you give yourself enough credit for how hard it really is to get strangers to open up to you on a podcast, which, of course, you are uniquely talented at doing. Oh.
Thank you.
But I get what you mean, though, about it being easier on a podcast than with someone you're really close to, because there's more at stake, right? There's more to lose if it goes badly.
Yes, absolutely. The stakes are quite different. And also your control of your emotions is quite different. You know, when the stakes are higher, it's easier to kind of lose your pacing, speed up, have defensiveness and anger get in the way of having the kind of conversation that you maybe intended to have. So this book is my sort of exploration of, you know, how to create the conditions to have the most successful exchange of communication when you're talking about something tough and vulnerable, and also about like looking straight at the hard thing and letting yourself off the hook for what they have to solve these hard conversations. Huh. I think a lot of our hard conversations are hard because we go in with an expectation that is totally unrealistic. Like we can fix someone's grief or we can make material differences inconsequential if we're talking about money, kind of like talk them away. And you can't.
So what is a good way to think about the value of these kinds of conversations, or maybe sort of an interim expectation in terms of what they can really achieve?
I think like this book is an exploration of five big hard things that most of us encounter in different ways in our life: death, sex, money, family tensions, hard conversations within family, and also hard conversations about identity. And what I really try to explore is like, if you go in with a sense of awareness about what is hard about each of these, specifically about each of these five big things, but instead go in with a spirit of curiosity about how the person you're talking to is experiencing something. Maybe it's grief or loss. Maybe it's, you know, a misunderstanding or a sense of distance within your family. That sense of curiosity, what that does achieve is it pulls you out of that place of isolation and stigma, which is like can be a compounding difficulty on top of something that's already hard. And a really, really compounding difficulty. You know, I you'd mentioned the end of my first marriage. And when I think back on that time, you know, so much of the pain was shame and not knowing who to talk to about, you know, someone else who'd gone through this. And as a young person, I was 30 when that marriage ended. And just finding those people that I could compare notes with, it was really healing and just kind of let me put my shoulders down a little bit and just go, yeah, this is tough, huh? And they go, yep, it's tough. You know?
I really think you're illustrating one of the key sort of arguments that you're making about why we should engage in these conversations rather than sort of compartmentalizing and just kind of making it work. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it really does make us feel less alone. And you mentioned isolation, but that connective tissue, I think, is the word that you use.
Yeah, connective tissue. And like what that does, that connective tissue, when you're tending to it, when you're building it, like that's what our relationships are made of. You know, like you're not just helping yourself out in that moment. You're building and reinforcing something important about that relationship that you can keep returning to each other to compare notes about what's tough, to ask each other for help. And that makes life more rich and full.
And you also talk about, as you said, going into the conversation with an awareness of why it's hard. And so one of the things that I want to explore with you, because I don't think I have done it that much on forum yet, is really exploring why conversations about money are so hard. We'll get to, I'll try to get to as many as I can in the book when you talk about death, sex, family, identity, and so on. But let's just talk about why initially, what you've learned about why money conversations are hard to begin with.
Oh my goodness, Mina, you went to the hardest one first.
Sorry.
I mean, okay, first of all, we have such little kind of concrete public vocabulary around money, you know, like we don't even have words. Mm. So when you go into a conversation about money, even in the most intimate settings, like when I'm talking with my husband about whether or not we should buy a rug, you know, like I might be thinking about money in this way of like, what do we have in our bank account, blah, blah, blah. And he's thinking it as like, what are the things that we invest in for our own comfort to create this house together? So you use the same words and you're meaning different things. And this woman named Amanda Clayman, who's a financial therapist, says money is both, obviously, a tool, and money is also a symbol. And so when you're talking about money, you're talking about both this very concrete material tool that enables you to spend, save, borrow, et cetera. And it's also wrapped up in all sorts of things around your cultural background, your beliefs about, you know, earning and money and how interdependence and independence. And when you don't kind of practice talking about money, all of those really big emotional things kind of get just like, you know, they're just in the background and they're causing really strong emotions. But because we don't practice like, oh, I see why it's important to you to like send this money to your family member. Like in your family, you have a much more sort of open, you know, exchanging of money. You help each other out, you invest together, you know, whereas in my family, that's not something we've done. It's all about like proving that you can stand on your own two feet, you know, like opening up those conversations can help you learn a lot about why the money conversations are hard when you put words to them.
Yes, I love this line that you had where you say the best place to start any money conversation is to admit that money is about much more than money.
Yeah.
And it's true, as you were saying, that people have different, people really don't even know what it means, or it means so many different things to different people. As you were saying, for some people, it means that it's how you sort of stack up against others, or if you have a lot of money or not, it was because of some personal characteristic or failing of yours, as opposed to structural forces that may have played a major role in whether you were able to make it, or whether or not you're struggling along. The other thing that I think is really was really interesting is that money is something that you pointed to as part of the reason that you were able to move on from your first marriage, because you finally realized that agreeing on what money is revealed that you and your partner actually didn't have the same plan for your lives.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you start arguing about whether or not you're going to go out to dinner and spend that money. And then you realize like, oh my God, we want totally different things. Like that was like a really long process, because to me,
you know, it was really hard because it's like, oh, are we such a cliche that we're like arguing about money and that's why our marriage is ending? Like, it felt so like small kind of and mundane. Like, why can't we figure this out? And then as we, you know, did the work, we read the books, we went to the couples counseling, and then finally we had a conversation where my ex just spit out. He's like, we don't want the same things. Like, I want to travel the world and make art and be a filmmaker. And you want a house and kids. I don't want that. And it was shattering to just have that be sort of blurted out. Finally, this like big conflict that we were sort of arguing around the edges of. And that was a really hard conversation. And for a long time, I thought of that as like a failed conversation because we didn't figure it out. We didn't come back together. And as I worked on this book, it's been more than 10 years, like thinking about like, oh, actually, that's when we finally got to what we needed to say to one another. Like, yes, we didn't want the same things. And once we sort of allowed that to be the outcome of talking about all of these, you know, battles that we've been having, it was easier to move forward.
You're almost redefining what connection means. We were talking about how one of the reasons to engage in these hard conversations is to feel more connected. And it doesn't necessarily mean that after you have that conversation, you are going to be physically more connected or the marriage is going to be saved, but you are going to be connected in terms of a truth, a shared truth or shared realization, it sounds like.
Yeah. You know, I actually was really helped by years ago, I saw a Stanford business professor giving a talk and she was talking about negotiation. And she was talking about the idea of, you know, a successful negotiation being when you get to yes. And she was arguing like, no. That is not the only definition of a successful negotiation. A successful negotiation is when you both come to the table and you say, I'm willing to give up this and I'm willing in order to have this. And the other person says similarly, and you realize like, okay, we can make a deal. It's also a success. You have negotiated if in the end you decide like, actually, this isn't the right deal and you walk away. And that's how I like to think of hard conversations. It's like, you're going in with this other person to really try to understand where they're coming from with a sense of curiosity as much as you can, even when it's really sad and emotional and angry, and understanding what they're saying and then seeing like, as I'm listening to this, how does this match up with what I think and want and need? And you're discovering that about each other. You're having this exchange, and it might be that in the end there's not resolution, but you've given the relationship the respect of trying to really understand what's happening in between you two.
We're talking about how to have difficult conversations with Anna Sale, author of Let's Talk About Hard Things and podcast host of NPR's Death, Sex, and Money. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. What are some conversations you've had that you want to tell us about? What hard conversations have you avoided? What are your questions about how to have them with Anna Sale? 866-733-6786, the number, and we'll get to your calls soon. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. As the host of NPR's podcast, Death, Sex, and Money, Anna Sale isn't afraid to talk about difficult topics and more with complete strangers. But as she notes in her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things, she says it's downright terrifying to discuss the things that are the most important to us with the people who are most important to us. But Sale says that is exactly what we should do. So tell us, what are your questions for Anna Sale about how to have these hard conversations? What are some hard conversations that you've had that you want to tell us about? Or the hard conversations you haven't had that you also want to tell us about? 866-733-6786 is the number. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. So I want to talk with you a little bit now, Anna, about death, in part because this is something that is so much a part of our lives. So many of us are processing the deaths of loved ones. And one of the things that I really loved in your book was when you talked to a therapist who said skillful communication about death starts with an awareness that nothing you say is going to fix it or make it go away. And that really is something that you've been saying throughout, even at the very beginning of this conversation. But can you talk about why that's so important in the context of death?
Yeah. Oh, because I think it's just goes against all of our most caring, you know, understandable caring impulses. When we want to comfort someone who is in deep grief, we want to help lift the pain. And the therapist you mentioned, her name is Megan Devine, and she has a book out that's called "It's Okay That You're Not Okay," and she writes about kind of coming to this awareness of how to instead try to meet someone and validate the suffering and the pain that they're going through rather than trying to problem solve it. And she had the personal experience of she lost her partner when he was 39. They were hiking together and he was swept away and drowned in a river. So a sudden death, a shattering tragedy. Yeah. And she told me, this quote that has really stuck with me. She said, people feel really helpless in the face of someone else's pain and they want to make that pain go away so they can stop feeling so helpless. Hmm. And she really felt that in that way of like well-meaning people saying things like, oh, you know, you're young, you'll find someone else, you know, or even let me know if I can do anything for you.
Yes.
And for her, she's like, let's tease out the logic of let me know if I can do anything for you, which is something, you know, I have said, people say,
me
it's,
too.
It's a thing that you say. And she said, you know, here I was, it took every ounce of energy I had to just wake up every morning and realize how my reality was completely upside down. And then when I heard this from someone, I had to think, oh, what would be helpful for me right now? Who is the person that I should ask for that? And then how do I get over that weird feeling of not wanting to ask for help and then ask, you know? And she compared that to someone who, you know, just like offers to, I'm coming by and I'm going to walk the dog, you know, a couple times a week, just these small ways, or I'm going to text you and you don't have to talk to me. I just want to keep checking in with you because I'm worried about you. And will you just text me back an asterisk and let me know that you're just having quiet time? Because it is a real worry when someone you know is in deep suffering and loss. You want to hear from them and know that they're at least, you know, eating and taking care of themselves and waking up in the morning. And I thought that was a really graceful sort of tip. Like, so she did. She did that with a friend. She would just text back an asterisk sometimes when she didn't have the energy to talk. She didn't want to feel like she had to perform that she was somehow like doing okay with her grief. But she could tell her friend, I'm here. I'm here. You know?
Yeah. Well, let me go to caller Caroline in Gilroy. Hi, Caroline.
Hey, I hope you can hear me okay. I'm on my car phone.
Yeah, we can make you out. Go right ahead.
Okay, great. So this topic is on death. My husband died almost 10 years ago now, relatively young. But something I was surprised about was finding out that people really flinch when you say the words dead, died, death. It's like you're saying a dirty word.
Huh.
Yeah. And I kind of had to start using the euphemisms I hate, like passed away or my late husband, which I really hate because he was always very punctual. it's just weird to me that death is really that odd a topic and, you know, just so verbose. And I wondered if you had anything to say about that.
Thank you for that. I think your connection is getting a little bit more staticky, but I did hear what you were saying about just people flinch with the word death. And Anna Sale, this reminds me so much about the story that you tell in the book of your conversation with a woman named Sue about her friend Shelley. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because in that conversation, it sounded like there was a real reckoning with the need to talk about death and call it what it is and describe it for what it was.
Yeah, I love this story. Well, I first want to say I'm sorry for the loss of your husband.
And
one tip that I recently heard, and I just love it when I've done it. It's so neat when someone, you know, who you're just meeting mentions someone who's died in their life, whether a partner or a child or a sibling. When you say like, oh, what was their name? And then to see what happens when you ask that to the person, their face kind of lights up and they're given an opportunity to sort of tell you about who they lost and who they were and remember them together.
Yes.
It's just a beautiful thing that happens. So that's a nice tip to take with you. I met Sue as a very good friend of mine, and I started talking with her about death because I am very good friends with her mother, who is named Anne, and Anne is now in her late 80s. And I interviewed Anne about aging because I got to know Anne when she was already in her 80s, and I would find that we would hang out and then I would go home and I would have this like, I hope she knows how much I care about her and love her because I know I don't have unlimited time with her. And so as part of writing this book, I sat down with Anne and I just sort of said like, what's it like to be in your mid 80s? Like, how are you thinking about, you know, decline and you know, the way what's comfortable for you when someone offers an arm when you're walking next to you? Like, it was a really nice conversation that I wanted to somehow like make me feel not worried that I was going to lose my friend Anne. And of course, one day she will die. But we did have that time together for me to say, I don't want to lose you. I love you so much. I treasure this friendship. And that's what conversation can do. But after I had that conversation, I was telling Sue about it. And Sue, her daughter, she sort of like has this joke that she will not engage with the question of her parents passing away. It's too painful. And she sort of like covered her ears and sort of went, la, 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 la. Like, that's what I do when this comes up. And I was like, okay, we don't have to talk about that. But then she told me at the same lunch when we were having this conversation, she was like, actually, I was just at this funeral of my friend Shelley. And her friend Shelley was a woman who got melanoma and pretty quickly realized it was terminal. And she made the choice for herself that it was comfortable to sort of document her decline, to tell people about, you know, the medical interventions and what it did to her body and take pictures and share it. And Shelley described being at the funeral where it was her choice, like to, you know, when they have a slideshow of images, you know, there were pictures of Shelley in her most vibrant self, you know, cheering on the sidelines of a football game. You know, there were pictures of her as a kid. And then there were also pictures of her, you know, kind of very fragile after chemo with her hair gone, and she's holding her dog's face in her hands, like kissing her dog. And it showed the whole arc. And that was a choice that Shelley made. And it was something I talked to her brother about it because he was very up close and with her while she was declining. And he said kind of as a family that they wanted to share that whole process with people because if they had not seen her when she was sick, if they remembered her as this, you know, healthy, vibrant, you know, woman, the shock of it might be just like too much to absorb. Her brother Mike said, you know, I saw it. I saw what this cancer did to her, and I wanted to help people see what she went through and the way that she faced it open-eyed and kind of bringing her family and friends along with her towards the end. And something Shelley would say to her brother towards the very end, she would just say like, is there anything else you need to know? Like they really went into it. They looked at it together and it was sad and scary and didn't make any sense, but they were with it, with each other till the very end.
I think it's so interesting that you talk about how we want to make other people feel better about death, like we want to solve it for them or fix it, as you were saying. But that actually, and one of the ways we do it is really by avoiding talking about what it means and how it takes from us, as Caroline was talking about with the euphemisms and the late for husband and so on, right? But that what really does help us as part of the grieving process or avoid the sense that that our grieving process is incomplete in some ways is to be able to really name it and talk about it. One of the things you made me think about when I was reading is, I'm actually a very private person and I don't normally share things, but I did decide to put out on social media that my aunt had passed away. And one of the things that I always admired about people who do this was I was like, oh, they're so brave and clear-eyed. Like, they know they need others to display care, so they're announcing this on social. And what I realized when I did my own was that that is absolutely not why I was putting it out on social, right? I wasn't asking for displays of care. What I needed people to know was that she existed. Like, there was this sense of like, I need you to know she was out there and lived. And so I think just sort of the assumptions we make, it's so interesting. The assumptions I made before I was in the same situation.
Yeah, I remember seeing that, Mina. I'm really sorry for your loss. And she was far away. You weren't able to be with family to memorialize her together as a family, right?
Right. And I wonder if that need, which is something that is shared a lot by people through the pandemic because they aren't able to be there for those rituals, was in part because it sort of almost didn't feel real to me without it.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us her name?
Her name was Haeyoung. Kim Haeyoung. Kim Haeyoung Kim. But thank you. And I do get the power of that, too. It's so interesting. We had a caller last Friday who shared a memory about his mother and the kind of food that she would make for him. And asking him what her name was really did bring out quite a touching moment.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
Well, thank you. And let me go to caller Nancy in Northern California next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I have a very particular dilemma. I am one of six siblings, and when my mother was elder and before she died, she divulged to me that she had been sexually assaulted by her own father, and not just once, but throughout her whole life, and that she was at home. And she also told me that she hadn't told anybody else but my father. And I am the youngest of my siblings. It was hard to hold that information. I have shared it with my sisters, but I have three brothers that I have not shared that information with. And I have no idea how to have that conversation with them.
Yeah. Well, that's very, I think, is your mother still living?
No, my mother has passed away, but
yeah.
I've avoided my brothers for years because I hold this information.
Yeah. Yeah. First, I want to say that's really hard. I think when we learn new information that causes us to sort of have to rewrite the entire narrative of our family and what we understand about how our families, our family's history, it's, I just want to say, like, of course it's deeply unmooring. I think it's like, it's thinking about like what, if I tell one brother or if I tell all my brothers, like what will happen is I am going to like disrupt what they think the story of my family is. But the trade-off for that is I won't feel like I'm holding something back from them. We will have a more honest understanding. Like, and it sounds like it's interesting that you say it's made you feel distant from your brothers because you're all holding this alone, or you are holding this and they don't know. So I think it's kind of like if you do choose to disclose, it's kind of some general advice that I have for starting any hard conversation. Is just to begin before you go into the conversation, think about like, what do I want to say to the person I'm talking to about why I want to talk about this? So you have those words at the ready. So if you do, sitting at a kitchen table with one of your brothers, or you call up one of your brothers, you can say like, hey, I have something important I need to talk to you about. Is now a good time? And when you sort of signal that, like the person who, isn't expecting maybe a hard conversation, they hear you saying like, we need to move into a different mode. Like, is now a good, can you do this right now? Or should we schedule a different time. And if they say, one of them says, I'm okay, like, let's talk. And then you kind of begin with like, I have something that's upsetting to share with you. And it's about our mother. And I have held this and I haven't known how to tell you or whether to tell you, but I've decided that I think you should know, because otherwise you have an incomplete picture, if that's what you choose. And just really try to say, you know, this is prepare the person you're talking to hear what's coming, like you are going to tell him something that is going to be shattering, and that you're doing it for these reasons that you have thought a lot about. Of course, if you decide, like, I'm not sure that these relationships with my brothers can hold that, then it's a different set of choices, which is to say, like, there's some things that some parts of me and some things that I won't share with my brothers going forward, because I don't feel safe, or I don't feel like it's appropriate for our relationship for me to disclose this. So I think it's that kind of thinking about whether to disclose first before you think about how to do it.
Well, Nancy, I want to thank you for that call and for sharing that with us. One of the things that I'm thinking about, Anna Sale, and in listening to the advice that you gave Nancy, was also about a situation when it may be reversed, where you are suspecting that there is something that somebody wants to share with you or needs to share with you, and you want to be able to set the conditions to be able to have that kind of conversation. What have you found as somebody who's often pulling that from people that is so key in that kind of scenario?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, it's kind of like modeling the kind of conversation you want to have. You know, it's often about, like, sometimes I think in social situations, or if it's like a small talk catch up, you know, kind of thing. I just in the last few weeks, I have found when I'm like, oh man, you know what I have found is really helpful. I'm doing these like walks around my neighborhood and talking to my therapist. Like, I'm just taking her for a walk. And when you just are, when you're the person in the phone conversation to say that first, then the other person's like, oh, I can't tell you how hard this time has been, you know, instead of just being like, you know, how are you, you know, doing the thing. If you just create that opening, then people will walk through if they need to talk. So think about, like, how can I be that friend? How can I be that friend that they know that I'm a person that they can kind of go a little bit more nuanced and complicated with?
We're talking about how to have those meaningful but hard conversations with Anna Sale, author of Let's Talk About Hard Things, Known for Death, Sex with Money, the NPR podcast. We'll have more with her after the break and with you, our listeners. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Anna Sale about her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. Sale is the podcast host of NPR's Death, Sex, and Money. And you, our listeners, are telling us about hard conversations you've had, how they went, conversations that you've avoided, and you're asking questions of Anna Sale about how to have those hard conversations. 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number if you want to join the conversation. Our email address, forum at KQED.org, and we're at KQED Forum on Twitter and Facebook. And let me go to caller Sarah in Santa Rosa next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. How are you guys, ladies?
Well, how are you?
Good. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Yeah. What's on your mind, Sarah?
My son, Patrick, he's 3, turning 4 this year. He doesn't know his father. And that's partially the reason it's my choice. And I'm still not sure about my choice. And I was wondering, how do I have that conversation with him? What age is it appropriate to bring it up? He teases that, you know, my sister's boyfriend sometimes will call him dad. He'll call him dad and that. But I don't know what age is appropriate to have a conversation with him. It is involving some adult stuff. The conversation will be about adult stuff. My, how is this? His father has like a criminal background. And so I don't really know what to tell him, how I should tell him, at what age. And it eats at me like every day. Like, what should I do? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Sarah, thanks. Yeah.
Thank you for this question. And I have to say, like, I think there are more appropriate people. I would do some Googling about like child psychological development and things like that, just to kind of get a sense. I'm not an expert on that. But what I will say is, you said you don't know. You haven't decided whether and how to tell your son who his father is. So you're in that space of you don't know what to do. So that's okay. You don't know yet. But you do have a family with him. So one way to like just kind of begin the conversation, maybe, and maybe you've already done this. I mean, he's certainly noticed. I have a 4-year-old. Is, you know, say like, here's who's in our family. Here's who loves you. And here, you know, this person, this person, this person, this person. This is what our family looks like. You know, what is this person's, you know, your friend at preschool? What does his family look like? Just like introducing the ideas that family can look different ways, in different families. And then you sort of can come to that question of, you know, it seems like you're not just asking, what does my son need to understand about who his father is, but also like, how would I manage my son then wanting to have a relationship with his father? Those are big things that you'll sort of like learn what you need to disclose, also based on what your son is asking you, you know, as mm-hmm. he gets older. I think that listening to your son about what he needs and wants to know is an important thing. I think it's something I write about in the book, even with adults of grown children, being reminded that it's really important to listen and not just talk and try to guide and keep parenting. That can be really important for building adult relationships between kids and parents. But good luck to you. What I would say is just begin by talking about who his family is, who's in his life right now that loves him and is keeping him safe and is his family. And then to sort of let it unfold based on what you hear from him back.
Yeah, I will. Actually, I will look up a child psychologist. That's a good idea. Thank you very much.
Sarah,
enjoy your conversation. Thank you.
Well, really appreciate you calling in and sharing that. And I think, Anna, also your answer to Sarah addresses a question that we also got from Grace about how you fold younger families into conversations about hard things. This listener, Gary, wants to know how you talk with someone who will abandon fact and truth in order to win an argument. I've had this problem in 2 previous relationships. It was intimidating and overwhelming, impossible to reach any kind of resolution unless I simply gave up.
Yeah,
what Gary is saying about this notion of abandoning fact and truth really has so many meanings, I feel like, in this age.
Time. And I think it's really, I think the question is, like, is there another reason to figure out how to have a relationship on different terms with that person? You know, there are some relationships where it's like, oh, something as basic as like, you don't agree the sky is blue and I am under a blue sky every single day and it affects my life, you know, or something more fundamental to your identity. Like, I don't believe that the way you're living your life is moral and I reject you. So then that's a relationship that you can decide this isn't a healthy relationship for me to have. I don't need this person in my life. There are other situations though. I mean, all of us probably have had a friend or a family member in these last few years where there are basic facts on which we cannot meet eye to eye, whether it's about politics, whether it's about the pandemic. And then it's about thinking about, is there another reason can we talk about other things that aren't about politics in a way that still feels like I'm not dishonoring myself or disrespecting myself. And I tell a story in the book it was a woman named Pam Daglian, who's a life coach actually in San Francisco. And she reached out. I was sort of looking for stories of people who had figured out how to have successful family relationships where you talk, where there are really key, deep value differences and political differences. And she told me about her relationship with her stepfather, George, who is now in his late 80s. And they had long had tension. They hadn't gotten along basically their entire relationship. And then Pam's mother developed dementia. And in 2016, George moved Pam's mother into an assisted living facility. And Pam was still visiting. And all of a sudden, she's staying alone in George's house, a house, you know, in a relationship that had always previously been mediated by her mother. And it's in the middle of the 2016 election. And they have very different politics. George is a conservative Baptist in Upper Michigan. Pam identifies as a political liberal. And there's a lot on which they don't agree. But what happened in that relationship, it started, Pam noticed that George turned off Fox News when she was in the house. And it was something that he usually always had playing in the house. And she saw that gesture and appreciated it. And they started watching Family Feud together, because Family Feud is something we can all watch together. And then finally, George just said to her, what he said, you know, our relationship is more important to me than politics. So he just said it.
Yeah.
And what hearing that did was it allowed them to sort of begin actually talking about politics. They could be curious about each other. You know, George would ask Pam about sanctuary cities and why she thought they were okay. And Pam would ask him, you know, what his views were, you know, why he had these views on immigration. And they had established that there was something else tying them together.
Yeah.
And it really, they became very important supports to each other as Pam's mother continued to decline and through her death last summer. And so I think that that's a situation where you can put up guardrails and you can say, this is an important relationship to me. And I don't agree with all of these ways in which you are, you know, we don't agree on basic facts here. But a critical difference there is that George was also willing to join in conversation with Pam. You know, when you're trying to have that kind of back and forth with someone who instead always wants to win the argument, is just going to try to sort of be a freight train over any feelings that you have, that doesn't sound like a relationship. There's that can be, you just have to decide, like, is there something else? Is there a reason to put up with this? Yes. Or not?
Well, let me go to Jean in San Francisco. I think Jean has something sort of related to this. Jean, join us.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask your guest what role she thinks morality plays in the discussion about the five difficult subjects to discuss. I mean, it's personal morality that, you know, is the impetus for the action, right? And for the behavior. So if you're talking about money, for example, if you send $50 to the Trump campaign or you send $50 to the Buttigieg campaign, you don't really want to talk about, it seems like the whole conversation here is about treating the symptoms instead of the disease. And I know that in the past, I'll just say one briefly, you know, churches and synagogues and temples and so forth used to, you know, play this role. You know, a meaning community would play this role, sort of fallen by the wayside. But I was raised Jewish, and, you know, I read very early, you know, for the stranger within your gates, there shall be one law for you and for the stranger within your gates. So that sort of formed my thinking, you know, whether you think the Torah is a valid document or, you know, just mythology, it doesn't really matter. It formed my thinking about the immigration discussion. So where are you getting your moral, you know, impetus for whatever? Yeah.
Yeah. Jean, thanks. Anna?
I think that's a really important question. And actually, it's like, I think that that's the conversation I want to have with you. I want to understand, like, oh, like, tell me more about this, like, where you got your clarity on right and wrong and what were the inputs. And
right.
I want to know about that, you know? And certainly I'm sure that there's, you look at somebody's choices or political beliefs and you say like, that is not aligned with my very clear sense of right and wrong. And I think, I guess I take the position, like, I just take the position of like, if there's a way to have a conversation where each party can listen even while they're disagreeing and can try to bestow a sense of dignity on the person they're talking to, then you're going to uncover the places where some of that morality overlaps, where it diverges, you know, and be having a respectful exchange. You know, I'm not advocating for sort of like, in any way, like flattening differences and saying like, oh, what you're saying is 100% valid and what I'm saying is 100% valid and they just don't overlap. No. In these conversations, you are like churning up and comparing really deep things. And to be sort of curious about those differences. Like that's what my chapter about identity is about like, oh, like how do we have a conversation where we can better understand how you move through the world and how the world responds to you based on some aspect of your identity. And I'll tell you what I've noticed and what I haven't noticed, because for example, you know, I'm a white woman, like what I haven't noticed, like, and just sort of like create a more complicated, nuanced understanding of each other's experiences.
Well, I want to thank Jean for that, because I think too, one of the key things is knowing, like when you talk about not flattening things, right? And I think one of the key things is also knowing what you're really talking about and what you're not really talking about. So for example, you had mentioned the word earlier, politics, right? And Jean was bringing up political examples. But there are so many things that we're really talking about that politics isn't really the right word to describe it. Because by saying, for example, politics is more important to me than our relationship is more important to me than politics, what is happening in terms of the public discourse that has involved our political leaders is a lot more sometimes than just politics, right? It's race, it's dignity, it's so many things that are core to who people are. But it gets sort of, you know, pulled into this word that can often be batted down as something not as meaningful as it really is.
Yeah. Or just like, oh, I understand which side of this I'm on. And if you're on the other side, what do we have to say to each other?
Exactly.
Particularly right now.
Puts you into these contrived camps or categories. And then that also stifles it. Well, Jean, thanks for bringing that into the conversation. And I do want to remind listeners that you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Let me see if I can get one last call in here. Maybe Jane in Montana. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Our daughter is in a profession in healthcare and understands the public health side of being immunized and has started the process. Her fiance is dead set against inoculations, and their wedding in September is a little iffy because they've both kind of dug in their heels and they say, I need to be inoculated, but I don't because I work at home, and it's going to be a wedding with people hugging and so forth. And I'm just wondering how we can negotiate, help them figure this out, because it's kind of, it's become a black and white issue.
Oh, that's so
hard.
Yeah. That is so hard. I mean, there's a couple of questions I have is, you know, what is your daughter kind of expressing to you that she needs from you? And like, what is she trying to figure out? Like it comes down to, like them figuring out how to have the conversation about like, what matters more, you know, it doesn't matter more that, you don't feel forced to get a vaccine. And this is making me feel not heard, not respected, uncomfortable about asking our family to gather. And also makes me question, you know, how we move through the world and whether it's aligned. You know, it sounds like that's uncovering a very fundamental, impasse. And it sounds like, that's a conversation between them, and you figuring out how you can support your daughter and where are her lines? You know, what is the line for her?
Well, Jane, thank you for the call. And you know, one of the things is I listen to our listeners share stories. For example, Michelle writes, my husband and I have been in therapy to find connection and intimacy. He just told me that he's not sure he actually loved me early on in our relationship. He thinks it may have just been infatuation or sexual attraction. I've been in therapy for sexual trauma and trust issues. And one reason I fell in love with my husband was the safety and security I felt. I believed he was different from the other men that hurt me in the past. I'm so angry about this current revelation. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but, you know, stories like that and stories about, for example, Lisa saying, I find myself waiting for the right time to have hard conversations. Conditions never seem right. Years have gone by and I'm still waiting. I feel like through so much of reading your book and the thinking that you've done about the best ways to have conversations, you have unlocked a lot of new insights into kind of the human condition, like who we are, what drives us, what needs we have, how we're hurt, where our sensitivities are, tender places, as you say. And we just have a minute left. So I was wondering, as we reflect on the things that we've heard today and the kinds of things that people were willing to share, what you feel like you have really learned through this process of thinking about it through the medium of conversation?
Yeah. I mean, I just would say that specifically to those last two comments, like those sound like really hard things. And I have found like when you hear other people's stories of going through these kinds of like huge collisions and really hard things, it is a comfort. And it also is strengthening. It allows you to see like, oh, that person went through a really hard thing in their relationship and they realized like this is what was important to them for the future. And this is how they made those one step at a time, made those moves forward. So I think it's just about you're not by yourself. You're not by yourself as you go through this stuff. And that's what I hope, like picking up this book, it's not just like a how-to guide. It's also like, oh, look at what all these people have gone through and they're on the other side, you know? And that can be just a really important sense of relief. You're not on your own as you're trudging through this hard stuff.
Well, that's definitely what you and our listeners have been for me. So my thanks to you, Anna Sale. My thanks to our producer, Grace One, for this. And my thanks to you, our listeners, for listening to Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.